Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. A question. When you hear the term liberal, do you think godless? Today's speaker says, in the context of history, you shouldn't. In her new book, The Religion of Democracy, scholar Amy Kittelstrom chronicles seven thinkers who embodied liberal ideals, influenced early American democracy, helped guide its progress, and did so with their religious values firmly in tow. Historically, the English Reformation caused political and theological shifts, the rise of common law, universal values, and the sharing of new knowledge and ideas among scholars. It made possible a liberality of thinking that led to the Age of Enlightenment and the rebirth of democracy. Kittelstrom posits an American Reformation, which resulted in further political and religious shifts away from orthodoxy and towards the values of equality, liberty, and democracy. She says moral values were crucial to the process and clearly derived from religious roots. She explores this movement from the first Boston liberals through the 20th century, finding evidence of the ties between liberty and faith in the struggle for democracy. Amy Kittelstrom is an associate professor of history at Sonoma State University. She specializes in 19th century American thinkers and their socio-political context. She is the author of The Religion of Democracy, Seven Liberals and the American Moral Tradition. Kittelstrom spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on July 7th, 2015. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording.
Thank you for coming. I'm really glad to be here. I'm glad for several reasons, which I will enumerate. The first of which is it's great to be in a bookstore. It's actually so great to be in a bookstore. It makes me choke up a bit. I adore books. I figure we have this in common. And one of the things I think about books is that the choices we make about which books to read really shape our character, shape who we are. And, when I was a kid and read my head off, in my community library, I really thought that it was going to be possible for me to read all the books. I mean, I was making pretty good headway, And then when I was about fifth grade, I came across how many volumes are in the Library of Congress, and I was dismayed. It was impossible for me to do that. Since then, I have matured a little. And in the course of researching and writing this book, I realized that there is a sort of result, a sort of logical result of this fact of the infinitude of knowledge, right? The fact that there are way, way more books than any of us can read. And that is that no matter how many books we've read, we need to keep in mind that there are many, many more that we haven't, and that other people will have read books that we haven't. And therefore, however proud we are of whatever knowledge we have, we should hold that pride in harmony with a kind of humility that leaves us open to listening to what other people have to say. So that's a sort of a preface to this conversation we're getting into. Obviously, I have some talking to do, and I have some things to share and things to impart. But then when I'm done with my presentation and listening to your questions, I hope to hear what perspectives you have to offer, as well as to continue to share with you based on whatever questions you have. So one reason I'm glad to be here is that I'm in a bookstore. And the next is that it's an independent bookstore, which is really important, hugely, hugely important for culture. To have independent booksellers, that means that there are people in this bookstore who make decisions about what books are they going to buy, how many copies are they going to buy, how are they going to arrange them. And obviously they do have to think of profit. This is a necessity of staying in business. But they have other ideas, and that helps create a community around a bookstore. So I'll share with you a little anecdote that didn't make it into the book, because you need some benefit from being here besides me just rehashing things that you'll be able to read if you choose to read the book. I was going to have, there's 7 chapters, I was going to have 8 chapters. One of them ended up dropping out during the writing because the ideas I'd had about what needed to go in that chapter found homes in other chapters. That chapter is going to be shaped around this one figure named Elizabeth Palmer Peabody, the Peabody family. If you've ever spent time in the Northeast, you know, it's quite prominent, but what we would call something like a degraded gentility or shabby gentility, right? They had a certain kind of lineage. They were sort of blue bloods and all, but they really didn't have much money. And Elizabeth Palmer Peabody never married. That meant she was an independent woman. And that means she had to support herself. Often this was teaching. But for a certain phase of her life, it was by running the best bookstore in Boston in the 1830s, the place, the only place you could go to get European literature, right, in the original languages, the only place you could get the science that was just getting, you know, cutting-edge science of the time, the higher criticism, or what I call biblical criticism, where scholars, German scholars mostly, were studying the Bible in the original languages and figuring out that the Bible was constructed as part of a historical process, which has vast implications for how you think about theology and so on. And her bookstore wasn't only the place to get, it wasn't only about acquisition, it was also about meeting people and fostering conversation and so on. So I like to think that we here today are sort of living in that legacy, that kind of a legacy. Something else about independence that I really want to stress that is in the book, but I think is also something we know, right? So we've just celebrated Independence Day, and what is signified by that generally is, oh, when the United States became independent from Mother England. And that's important. It's hugely important. Nationalism is not to be taken lightly. What I discovered in the course of my research and writing is that it's also about mental independence, about thinking for yourself, and about having the courage to speak your mind, just as things appear to you. And knowing that you live in a country where freedom of speech is guaranteed under the Constitution, so you're not going to be jailed for it, that's important. But it's also important to share this individual viewpoint you have in a community where other people with equally valid individual viewpoints might push back against your ideas, might challenge you, and so on, right? So I think this, the independence of this bookstore helps foster that independent-mindedness, which is crucial for democracy as well as for politics. And I think here in the West, right, in the West as a region of the United States, I think is particularly associated with this kind of independence, this willingness to just go ahead and be oneself. I'm glad to be here because what I know about you as an audience is that you chose to make use of your time on this Tuesday night to come here for whatever reasons you have. You must like books, and you also must be willing to talk about things that are often considered taboo. We are taught not to talk about religion and politics. But if you're here, you clearly are not afraid of talking about those things and thinking about those things, right? You actually consider those things important. And it is a risk, right? When you come up against what might be somebody's deeply held beliefs, and what if your belief is different? Well, that's actually the question that I started with long ago, getting into what turned into this book, is how can we believe something, really sincerely believe something to be true, valid, and important, cherish some belief, and at the same time, really respect somebody who holds a different belief, right? That to me is a philosophical question that I've treated historically by discovering a bunch of people in the American past who were preoccupied with that question also. right? So this is a place for us to engage in that. So I know that about you. And I also know that whether you end up liking this book or reading this book or not, you're at least interested enough in something that is not beach reading, right? I mean, it's a thick, dense, heavily footnoted book, so you're up for that kind of challenge. And so I appreciate that. And on this thing about conversation, so it took me 15 years to write this book, and for all of those 15 years, the main title was The Religion of Democracy. The subtitle changed probably 35 times. I mean, I just kept on rethinking what it was that I was trying to get across and so on. And one of the subtitles, it's not the one that survived. That one came from the publisher, right? I mean, I had some input, but Penguin was the source of that of this particular framing. But one of the subtitles I'd had in mind for a long time was to call it The Liberal Conversation. Okay, so two things about that. One is the way I use the word liberal is not the way it's used in contemporary political, I wouldn't even elevate it to call it discourse, warfare, right? Soundbite politics. I mean, what is it? You know, it became the L word in the 1988 presidential election, and it's a dirty word. It's something that people try to dodge. It's a bad thing. And I'm not going to engage, right, here with contemporary politics, not because I'm scared of them, but because the history I've discovered is so different from that kind of soundbite politics. So instead, the word liberal historically meant being open-minded, right? So holding your beliefs in an open-ended way, like knowing that your whatever it is that you think is true is provisionally true. It's true for now, and then let's go ahead with interaction and research and these kinds of things to see how they might change over time. So it's open-minded. It's inclusive because people of whatever background are welcome into it, right? I mean, this is the liberal idea. And it believes that progress is possible and desirable. And then, of course, we can have a discussion about what would add up to progress. What would it look like? What are the conditions, right? So that's the conversation, right? So conversation then, you know, there's this term, it actually, I think, comes from the 18th and 19th centuries, and that is about the art of conversation, right? The art of conversation, which is about display as much as anything. So that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about conversation as a social practice, right? As something that actually shapes culture, that actually contributes something. It's actually sort of an act of citizenship. And so then what are the sort of rules of conversation? Of course, it has to be rooted in a respect for others, right? A mutual respect, right? And a willingness to listen to others and to have an exchange. And when you disagree, not to attack the person, right? But to attack the argument. And there are classical roots of this. So if people know probably more than I do about the ancients, there was a development, you know, in that period of some kinds of rules for this kind of conversation. But where I'm finding it in American history, it is specifically Christian. And this was a bit of a surprise to me in the course of my research, because I started in the late 19th century with American thinkers who didn't identify as Christian. And then looking for the roots of where their ideas came from, I found them in New England Christianity. And about which I now am able to say a great deal. What it does is it overturns the general understanding we have about what American religion has looked like. So the dominant story is American religion is an evangelical Protestant belief in a specific function that Jesus Christ has in society, right? It's very specific, what I call the evangelical kernel. And what I discovered instead was something that I'm calling the American Reformation, right? And that is when Enlightenment ideas about the role of reason, universal values, and especially this thing about progress being desirable and possible, comes into this pre-existing Christian conversation about what is true and what is right. And those things together produce the belief that human beings are essentially equal, profoundly equal. And what they're equal in is their right to freedom and their duty to use this freedom in order to grow. And the technical term I'm using for that is moral agency. And that's a term I took from 18th century ministers in Boston. So we are moral agents in that sense. We are agents in the sense that we have choice. The moral part is the choices that matter are the ones that affect how we relate to others and our effect in society. So that's just a bit of a frame for where I'm coming from in presenting to you today. I can't do very well in giving you a step-by-step run through my arguments in the, it can take a while. It takes a while to unfold them. So I'm just going to try to give you one little taste of them in today's conversation. And thinking essentially of this group here as a kind of temporary fellowship. So the word fellowship is rooted again in this Christian practice, this idea that believers in a church community have a special fellowship with one another, and then that the purpose of that fellowship is to grow toward union with the divine, right? But there are lots of other kinds of fellowship, right? There are academic fellowships. There are academic fellowships that fund you for research, but there's also the sense of fellowship around a particular kind of idea. There's fellowship around all sorts of voluntary associations. I don't know if that term rings a bell here, but if anybody read Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, he thought voluntary associations, the thing that people choose to do together, contribute something absolutely crucial to democracy, right, to society. And also around particular activities, right? You can have a fellowship around some activity that you like and that you share. And I don't know if people are familiar with this book by the sociologist Robert Putnam, Bowling Alone, came out about 20 years ago. He argued that the social fabric of American life was unraveling because he used this index, the decline in bowling leagues, meant that people were not spending as much time together as they used to. I have my suspicions that they just transferred their allegiance to soccer, but this is not the place to get into that. The reason I brought it up is because hiking is one of those kinds of fellowships, and the passage I chose to read to you today gets you into a little bit of the early years of the American fascination with hiking and the outdoors and the role of wilderness and the mountains. And I feel like this is an appropriate place to use that, even though I'm talking about dinky little mountains from your perspective, because I've got the Adirondack Mountains of New York, which you might not call mountains. I mean, they look like hills to you. I don't know. You've got big ones out here. Yeah. But that's what they had. All right. So that's where I'll land you basically in the middle of my book. I'm going to read a passage that'll take about 10 minutes or so. And when I'm done, I'll open it up for questions. I'm going to go like this, or probably just like this when I'm quoting, so that I don't pause and say quote unquote, because I find that disruptive as a listener. I think you'll be able to hear anyway the change in language, because Victorians really were very different from us. So the way they would use words was different from our way of using words. And I'm putting you into the chapter around the thinker who started my thinking about this work. And so that's the philosopher William James, who was 1842 to 1910 is his lifespan. I was going to say he's arguably the most important American philosopher. How about I just be bold and say I think inarguably the most important American philosopher, because he wasn't a derivative thinker. He was an original thinker in one way. And he helped create this philosophy called pragmatism. I try to avoid isms for my reader friendliness as much as possible. He himself wasn't happy with that term for his philosophy because it's not the pretty word, but it was a philosophical export. And one of the reasons it's so important is that it helps save belief for modern life. It's compatible with scientific thinking. Here's a newsflash. Religion and science were compatible for a long, long time, and actually continued to be compatible for many sincere religious practitioners. Continues to be completely compatible with scientific findings, right? But during James's lifetime, the publication of Darwin's On the Origin of Species in 1859, which, by the way, the theory of natural selection was accepted by the vast majority of American Christians by 1875. So we're still having this argument, apparently, as a culture. So that's interesting. James thought a lot about, like I said, this question about the compatibility of an individual belief with other people's differing beliefs. And one of the reasons he's important is because he came up with this idea that our temperaments differ. What looks right to us has to differ. None of us can know all of reality. Therefore, we need one another to sort of supplement the reality that we do know. And we're never going to get to the infinite. Okay, so this is important, right? So whatever you think about God, whether you want to use that word or not, or whether you worship this concept or not, if God is infinite, then can't be grasped by a finite mind, right? You're never going to get there. The end is never reached. And so that has an implication, which is this, you know, supplementing with diverse viewpoints, and never stop in your quest for understanding, for truth and justice, right? For these kinds of things. So I think there's a lot more I could say by way of preface, but I'll just go ahead and read my passage and look forward to your questions and comments and whatever kinds of observations you have. So this is chapter 4, beginning of chapter 4. Just about every summer of his adult life, William James traveled to Keene Valley in the Adirondack Mountains of New York. After his bachelor days of solitary rambles and rousing talks by the campfire, he honeymooned there. And year after year, while his wife was tied to children and home, he returned there alone to meet others and to loaf, to give and hear lectures at nearby summer schools, to restore his nerves by light reading, and to stimulate them by hikes. He spent so much time sitting on a stone ledge above one camp that it was named for him. Still has his name. One July, late in the 1890s, when James had become as famous for his defense of religious faith as for his groundbreaking psychology, he trekked with a co-ed group of budding philosophers and social activists half his age to a camp at Panther Gorge in the valley. The moon was high that night, and James, always prone to insomnia, found himself in a state of spiritual alertness of the most vital description as he wrote home to his wife later. Yet he could not quite describe it. Thoughts of his family, hiking companions, and work all fermented within me, he told her, till it became a regular Walpurgisnacht. I spent a good deal of it in the woods, where the streaming moonlight lit up things in a magical checkered play, and it seemed as if the gods of all the nature mythologies were holding an indescribable meeting in my breast with the moral gods of the inner life. James had been thinking about the relationship between nature, morality, and ultimate truth all his life. Now, while his professional energies were focused on making sense of what the many varieties of human religious experience said about nature and the divine, he was preparing for the Gifford Lectures he had promised to deliver in Edinburgh, Scotland, 2 years hence. His own inner life ripened into the most intense spiritual experience he would ever have. The event bore an intense significance that he struggled to verbalize for his wife, one of everlasting freshness as well as immemorial antiquity and decay, of utter Americanism and every sort of patriotic suggestiveness, all intermingled with his personal relations so that memory and sensation all whirled inexplicably together. From this peak experience, he came to understand now what a poet is. He is a person who can feel the immense complexity of influences that I felt and make some partial tracks for them in verbal statement. James discovered that he himself could not find a single word for all that significance and don't know what it was significant of. So there it remains, a mere boulder of impression Doubtless, in more ways than one, though, things in the Edinburgh lectures will be traceable to it. He was right about that, although the mystical event did not appear as such in The Varieties of Religious Experience from 1902, the book that came out of the Edinburgh lectures, even while other personal experiences of James's did. Instead, the meaningful reality of religious experience, whatever its source or cause, became an unshakable conviction for him that night, because he had finally felt it himself after 3 decades of intellectual work on how scientific standards for claims to truth could be used to justify beliefs unsubstantiated by physical evidence. His answer, rehearsed in his popular addresses of the 1890s for international debut in Varieties, was that the truth of religious faith was found neither in the origins of religion nor in its articles of belief, but instead in its fruits for life, which made his approach to religion an entirely practical one. The value of such spiritual practice, though, James tied to a conception of the good that had been almost fully unhitched from its Christian origins in the American Reformation. Now, practice was to be guided by a universal ideal that escaped language almost as much as James's Walpurgis Nacht had. And when he tried to explain it as the mystery of democracy or sentiment of the equality before God of all his creatures, such a sentiment he felt to be as impossible to fully realize as ultimate reality was to be fully understood by the finite, partial, limited individual human mind. James conceived of this mind and its limitations in scientific terms that paralleled the Christian terms that his progenitors in the American Reformation had used to describe the same barriers to realizing the same sentiment of equality. Yet to strain toward universal human equality was to act religiously, which is to say, to act in reference to the infinite rather than the particular, the ultimate rather than the conventional, the divine, rather than the merely natural. And the religious act involved both believing in one's own cosmic significance, because such a belief aids moral effort, and imagining the equal inner divinity of others. Then one must act on the basis of this creative imagination. The dawn after James's epiphany in the woods, his companions rose fresh, and together they planned an ambitious hike, leading first up the Adirondack's highest peak, Mount Marcy, and then up and down several smaller mountains for a day that would add up to more than 10 hours of straight exertion. James had hired a guide, in part to haul some of his provisions, but in an act of misguided chivalry, he directed the guide that morning to carry some of the possessions of his female hiking companions instead, taking on himself, in his heavily fatigued state, a burdensome load for a long day that began with their embarkation from camp at 6 a.m. The young women were demonstrably more robust than James, who had been vulnerable to physical collapse since his early 20s and was now pushing 60. But he insisted and got his way and arrived at the lodge that night with the first symptoms of the heart ailment that killed him a dozen years later. His wife forevermore resented the young women for their usurpation of the guide's services, especially nettled by the one upon whom James was overtly sweet. But no one but James was to blame, except maybe patriarchy, a web of social assumptions too thick for most anyone caught in its grip to untangle. James was no exception, except that he did try to untangle it, rejoicing that the girls wore hiking trousers rather than skirts. Totally revolutionary in the 1890s. Taking from female professionals seriously and attempting, particularly in his essay On a Certain Blindness in Human Beings, which he mailed to that nettlesome hiking companion, Pauline Goldmark, an important social reformer of the Progressive Era, Pauline Goldmark, he tried to pry apart culture and nature from inner divinity so that the irreducible particularity of human individuals could stand out as vividly as their varieties of religious experience. The more diverse viewpoints on reality were respected and taken into consideration, James argued, the more the bounds of cultural hides might burst by attention to difference rather than mere tolerance. the more all individuals are seen as fellow strivers after the divine, bearing their own hidden chips of the divine, the more social progress is possible because the more reality is comprehended. In a crude but path-breaking way, James attempted to teach his fellow Anglo-Protestant members of the American educated elite to view laborers, the Chinese, women, African Americans, Filipinos, and immigrants from the universal perspective of the eternal rather than the limited perspective of their own cultural particular. For in this way, the world does get more humane. This pluralism, with invisible roots in that of Channing, William Ellery Channing as a minister is the subject of my third chapter. This pluralism, with invisible roots in that of Channing and visible shoots in 20th century social thought, James developed over his career without ever feeling he had mastered it. He called it the religion of democracy. It was the principal thing of which the Americanism he had felt in the woods consisted. The only summers James did not visit Keen Valley were those he spent in Europe, where he eventually became such a celebrity that one clerk at a conference in Italy almost fainted when he gave his name. The European education he spottily received in his youth, the European intellectual community he fostered over his adulthood, and the European audience that received and propagated his ideas were all important factors in the cosmopolitan universalism of his thought. But rather than distinguishing him from others in his American milieu, they were consistent with the values and practices of his most formative intellectual context, American liberal religion. James did not go to Germany for study by chance, nor was he the first American religious liberal to do so. He did not frequent Keene Valley by chance either. Hordes of social thinkers reared on the precepts of the American Reformation convened in the Valley all the summers of the late 19th century and into the 20th. James made his first attempts at intellectual production in the pages of the North American Review and the lecture hall of the Concord School of Philosophy, a post-Civil War institution inspired largely by Emerson, whose massive literary body lay between the post-Christian religious liberalism of James and his associates and their common ancestors in the American Reformation. Liberals viewed Darwin and the rest of modern science with sanguine hope. They were interested in the religions of India and the philosophies of Germany. They read romantic poetry and French literature, and they traveled to Europe for study, culture, and health whenever their finances and leisure allowed. Freedom and fellowship and deed not creed were their watchwords. And although James was never a card-carrying member of anything, he absorbed from the arenas of amateur liberal thought the meliorism that looked to the future and to progress as the measurement of success, as well as the faith that ideals could be used as practical guides for action. James was not alone in making ideals practical and in coloring them democratically, despite being one of a kind. The last time James went to the Adirondacks was in 1907, the year he published the book Pragmatism, a new name for some old ways of thinking, which formalized the philosophy he had named pragmatism in an address at the University of California at Berkeley in 1898. In the book's dedication, James claimed that it was from the English liberal thinker John Stuart Mill that he had first learned the pragmatic openness of mind. Pragmatism was an international hit, but it was also a co-production of the English and American sprouts from the liberal line of Reformation Christianity after the Romantic turn. Mill and James, neither ever Christians, both claimed a sort of divine right of private judgment. This phrase, the divine right of private judgment, came from these Christian theologians in 18th century New England. This is what they claimed the Protestant Reformation had given them. You know, well, God had given it to them, right? This is what they claimed as the basis for protesting against the Catholic Church or any doctrine in which they disbelieved. The divine right of private judgment or the liberty of conscience is intimately connected to the American idea of liberty, the political idea of liberty. Okay. So both Mill and James claimed a sort of divine right of private judgment married to an ideal recognition of others' equal rights of so judging. pragmatism really was an old way of thinking, made post-Christian, and as adaptive to different cultural lenses and mental diversities as James could make it, as well as a new one, bubbled up from the American intellectual scene, but instantly sparking fire in other countries. Pragmatism itself became a line in professional philosophy, which was international because it was academic, and which developed in increasingly specialized and technical ways, so that by 1905, James's wife could no longer understand his philosophy. But the practical idealism, of which pragmatism was one distinctive variety, remained popular during James's lifetime, international because it was pluralist, and serving as the guiding orientation of liberal religion headquartered in American intellectual centers, but increasingly practiced abroad as well. Hence, when James wrote home to his wife from the lodge in Keene Valley for the last time, he described the wonderful traveling companion he had happened to meet on the train, a splendid Romanian Jew named Moskowitz, on his way to a conference on ethics at the Keene Valley Summer School, begun by a late friend of James's. Moskowitz was reading a book by a British pragmatist, a correspondent of James's, and he worked for the same organization of ethical religion that employed James's brother-in-law. James found that he was an ardent pragmatist and one of the best human types I ever saw. Thank you.
I zeroed in near that chapter on just the part, John Stuart Mill and his wife co-producing, co-writing on Liberty?
On Liberty.
So if you want to share a little bit of that, but my question is, because I don't know, so from my philosophy study, from a wonderful young man in high school, I don't remember her getting any credit for On Liberty. Mm-hmm. So do you know any of the background, if he seemed to be so liberated, and from what you read, why didn't she get her name on? Why don't we know that?
Yeah. Okay. That's an electrifying question for me. And I'm so glad to talk about it more. So first of all, let's just put in a plug for On Liberty, which is available free and online. I think you should buy a copy from this bookstore, I'm sure. But, the bar is very low for reading On Liberty. It's short. It's very clear. It expresses really well the principle of liberty and democracy in a way that I think has ongoing relevance for us. Okay, so 1859 is when it was published, and put it into the context of the history of England, democracy was very young. I mean, it was really not a representative democracy yet. So John Stuart Mill was a big agent in that happening. I think one of the things that I'll give you two things from the book that I think are important reference points for us when we think about things that maybe bother us today, things that we want to see, things that we want to change. So one of those is this principle of liberty as you have the right to swing your fist around as much as you want until it meets somebody's nose, right? So yes, it's individualism. I mean, this is what's protected and guaranteed, but the government's job is to sort of step in when fists are meeting noses. And so I think that has a lot of application for contemporary issues, and I'll just name the environment as one that's really clear, right? So that environmental destruction hurts people who didn't earn that, right? So I mean, that's one reason it's important. And another is, and this is really gonna get to your question, John Stuart Mill was a feminist. He was one of the first male feminists. And one of the first feminists at all, okay? And Harriet, his wife, had a lot to do with why he became really alive to the problem of gender equality in the mid-19th century, right? This was a really important conviction for him, one he got a lot of flack for. He got a lot of flack for the relationship too, which I'll say more about. And in On Liberty, which, of course, he's writing at a time when Utah wants to become a state in the United States, and the Mormons are running Utah, and the federal government is saying, you've got to quit the polygamy if you want to join. And John Stuart Mill says, I don't think the government should legislate that, because coercion is a problem, right? So with a democratic form of government, we say it's by the consent of the governed. You know, this phrase comes from John Locke. It's a foundational text for American democracy as well as for British liberals. Consent, choosing. We're choosing to have a government. We're choosing to obey its laws. But you want to be as minimal as possible with how you coerce people, right? And so John Stuart Mill says, he abhorred the concept of polygamy. He really didn't like that. It violated his sense of justice. But he said, you can't have the government forcing the Mormons to give up polygamy. Instead, it has to grow out of their own cultural change and out of the government's guarantee of their freedom to choose otherwise, right? So those are just the two points on why on liberty is so important. So then on the relationship, Harriet was married. Her last name was Taylor, not Mill. They met through social circles and fell in love and did not consummate their relationship, abided in a kind of extended tension over this. She did actually leave her husband and live apart from her husband. So they traveled together, they dined together, they were together all the time. The gossip mills were churning. But it wasn't until after her husband died that they got married. And their union was short, 7.5 years, because then she died, right? This is life in the 19th century, death in the 19th century. And as he says in the passage you're remembering, it was their minds meeting more than anything that made their union so compelling. He said that her husband was nice and honorable, good character, but he just didn't, you know, stimulate that part of her, didn't get that part of her. And so it was by seeing how her beautiful, brilliant, incredible mind had been handicapped by the gender restrictions, the massive gender inequality of England in those years, that made him into a feminist. He thought, what could she have become if we had different cultural standards from the ones we have, if instead we had equality? And so he says in his autobiography, which is, I think, published 1873, a wonderful book to read, he said that he cannot claim authorship of the book, that it was the product of their two minds together. He would never even have thought of everything if it hadn't been for her. She was constantly giving ideas. He said it didn't matter which hand held the pen, right? Because it was so completely a product of their lives together. And yet her name is not there because we have a social stricture on female publishing that goes way back.
Was he self-conscious about the fact that it wasn't, that he didn't insist or he didn't go further?
And get her name on there? Yeah. No, he didn't go all the way to the explicit claim, which you and I would both like to see. And this is unjust that she doesn't get credit, right? And yet the way he described it, I think he did feel, I mean, I think he was trying to get that point across without being so explicit. But then one thing I think is interesting, one of the things I find interesting about this one. So John Stuart Mill, you look back at him, some people will say he was a conservative, okay? Because he thought people with more education should get more votes, right, than people who were not educated. So this looks like elitism. But this ties right into a problem that I believe is still with us, right? What's the matter with Kansas might be a shorthand to that problem, right? It's a fundamental problem. If you believe in equality, shouldn't you believe to people who listen to different news sources from you, right? Really ask them, where are they coming from? How does reality look to you, right? So, okay, but we're legatees of his thinking, and he hadn't gotten there, right? So I don't think conservative is the word for somebody who worked so hard to increase the amount of liberty in English politics. So that's one point. And then the other is the way scholars talk about him and debate about him. So I don't know if the name Gertrude Himmelfarb rings any bells around here, but she is a historian. I don't know if she's still alive or not. I haven't met her myself, so that's why I don't know. But she's written a good bit on, I think she is, on John Stuart Mill. And she questions his representation of his own life in the autobiography. Now look, as scholars, we shouldn't take sources at face value. We shouldn't take somebody's word for it. We should look for corroborating evidence. But the way it looks to me is, okay, so Himmelfarb is coming from a sort of neoconservative perspective. And so she likes to tear down idols. And there's some tricky gender play going on there. And I think she didn't buy John Stuart Mill's story about Harriet, because although they tried very hard to remain above the moral fray, you could look at her as a fallen woman. And because I think Himmelfarb wants to retain that kind of primary authorship, right? But your question also relates to much larger, maybe I would say subtext of my books. I mean, something that I thought about the whole time I was writing it relating to gender. So I myself am not a gender historian, right? I mean, that's not my primary lens of analysis, but it's also not something I'm going to drop, right? Something I'm always going to pay attention to. And Elizabeth Palmer Peabody, whose chapter disappeared, the two other women whose chapters stay in here, were never married, right? They were never married. So what happened to a woman who got married in the 19th century? She lost her legal status altogether. It was legally absorbed into her husband's political identity. Of course, she didn't have the right to vote, right? And she was quite busy with domestic tasks that subordinated her to other people's will. And so from this perspective, this liberal perspective in which independence is prized, women were by and large dependent, right? They were dependent. And how their voice got expressed, what are the requirements for expressing, what are the restrictions on that, really, I'll just say, pervasive in the era. So that's a great question. Any other questions? Yes?
We're talking about the interchange of ideas and freedom of interchange of ideas and so on. The line private judgment and all that. The respect for each other's beliefs. And wanting to get a feel for how did that evolve? It looks like we're setting from John Adams forward through the century. And so about John Adams' time, about that time was there were very deeply held religious feelings. And there was the Enlightenment. And there was an interchange. There were revolutions going on. And there, like you said, there was sort of an American Reformation. So with all those going on, in your, research, what kind of feel did you have for how free and how respected that interchange was? I mean, right now, the political mess we're in, nothing is really tolerated on each side. But I get a sense that during the Enlightenment, during those early days, that freedom of discussion, that discourse, how did you feel? And sort of the public give and take, was there more tolerance to each other's ideas, or was the freedom of discussion really there, or did some espouse it, but it didn't really walk the walk, I guess?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. And so one thing about getting into it, I'm just going to say about the Enlightenment in general, is that even the way I presented it in this talk is a little too simplistic. And it's especially simplistic the way it comes across in our contemporary conversations, where the Enlightenment is sort of coded as secular. And then the meaning of secular is free of religion or even opposed to religion, right? And that comes from what I think is a distorted view of the Enlightenment, distorted by magnifying the French Enlightenment and minimizing the British Enlightenment. right? And the German Enlightenment too, both of which were very pious. And the reason it looked the way it did in France had to do with the Catholic Church, the role of clerics, their authoritarian, from the Protestant perspective, their authoritarian control of the public mind, their implication in the royalty, the benefits they got, their rich lifestyles, all those kinds of things. And so the French Enlightenment, the philosophes, who often then represent the Enlightenment in our popular imagination, they were anti-clerical. And that sounded anti-religious. And so then we get this story about the Enlightenment and religion being opposed to one another. Well, if you go back in time and you read the sources in the moment, it sure doesn't look that way, right? Maybe, okay, so then another little note as I'm getting into your really good question is regional differences in what became the United States. So if you have your 13 colonies, let's go to Virginia, where Thomas Jefferson was. Free thinking, not really a pious place. Much more Francophilic than any other region. And so then in their writings, you're getting that kind of language about liberty and so on that actually does look a bit more secular in that way. But I'm saying this American Reformation is rooted in New England. And that New England had disproportionate cultural power across the 19th century, which has a lot to do with Harvard, because the liberals took over Harvard. It has a lot to do with the explosion of print media, because all the major publications were written by these people, and then they circulate and so on. So it loses its New England markers, but actually continues to have this massive power. So that sort of justifies, for me, my interest and attention in New England in particular. It's this tiny little ethnically homogeneous corner of a diverse nation, you know, if you go to the early republic, and yet it had this outsized importance. So then you're asking about, oh, really? Like how freely could people speak? Then I'm just going to say in New England. How honest could they be about what their beliefs were? How could they challenge others? And the answer is mixed, right? So for John Adams, who wanted to be a minister, he became afraid that his beliefs would not make him a successful minister. So his ambition and his convictions had a bit of conflict. And so he went into politics, and I think we're glad, you know, that was the right choice, into law and into the revolutionary scene. But he wasn't anticipating, nobody was anticipating that development in the 1750s when he was making up his mind. Nobody thought the revolution was coming, right, in the 1750s, right? So one of the things I discovered in my research that was pretty exciting was that the Congregational Church, so that's the established church in New England, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and then Maine, once Maine was created, right? The established church means the tax dollars go to support ministers and churches. Your participation was compulsory, right? I mean, this is in the colonial, right? And then this changes over the early republic, and we could break down why and how. But the Congregational Church is different from other Protestant churches because of this system where the congregation chooses the minister, okay? And the laity, the members of that congregation, are spiritually equal to the minister. Of course they respect the minister. Of course they listen to what the minister has to say. But they're Protestants. They read the Bible every day. You know, they pray on their knees or sometimes lying flat on the ground. You know, they know it back and forth. They don't even have to open it to quote it, right? And so if the minister preaches in a way that they don't like, and enough of them don't like it, they get rid of him, right? And they take somebody new. And so John Adams's fear was, he really wanted to be popular, which is so sad because we've got a couple hundred years and he's still not popular. But I don't think that's fair. And so could he get a job? And one of the reasons that he was leery of it is because the congregation that he attended after college, so he went to Harvard, and at that time he went to college at age 15. So when he's done, then he's a school teacher in Worcester, west of Boston, central Massachusetts. And the church there is a fire and brimstone preacher. Adams's favorite minister had been a candidate at that church, but they hadn't picked him. They had picked the evangelical Calvinist, right? And so that told him something about what his prospects were. But for me, the most striking discovery about the Congregational Church is that there was no Orthodox belief by the 18th century. Okay, it was always an argument about doctrines and principles and biblical interpretation. So you don't need the higher criticism. I mean, once it happens, those arguments get more intense, right? But the arguments were always intense because this is a matter of life and death, people, right? And it's not just ministers arguing with one another, although they did, but laity arguing with one another all the time. And so reading John Adams's diaries and seeing how he was debating theological opinions to himself, and then he was setting down conversations he participated in, and this person said that, and that person said this, and this person thinks that, he's noticing diversity of opinion, okay? So number one, any claim that there's such a thing as Orthodox American Christianity is absolutely false, because there never was a U.S. established church. There's no American pope. Right? There's nobody to say this is the way. There was always an argument across the colonies and in the early republic. But even in this congregational church that was the Puritans' church, there was this diversity of opinion. And it's not in the book, but if you go back to the 17th century Puritans and you start reading their sermons, they disagreed with one another too. Some of them had a very precise view of the doctrinal system that they thought the Bible pointed to, and others had an equally confident conviction. I mean, they're disputing pretty fine points. You have to read closely, you know, to get what arguments they were having, but it was not stable. They were trying, at least the first and second generations of the Puritans, they were trying to establish it and get it all set, but it never happened. It never set. It never congealed. And so religious arguments, theological arguments, I think, you know, provided a kind of testing ground or proving ground for the later political arguments. But then all sorts of things happen when you get the party system. And so then this, you know, your question about how free was free inquiry? Well, you know, Jefferson and Adams had some conflicts, which I, you know, find quite engaging. But they kind of, after they both had finished their presidencies, they returned to friendship and correspondence. And John Adams, writing to Thomas Jefferson, said, you know, however much we boast about our free inquiry and so on, it's not really happening, right? And this is because public opinion can be oppressive, and people like to conform to the majority, right? So this is what, you know, again, in Tocqueville is called the tyranny of the majority, and how is this a problem and how do you counteract it? But for the liberals, this is why independent thinking is so important. And so we have like Thoreau and Emerson that are sort of literary representations of that. But guess what culture they came from, right? This very culture in which conformity was dangerous. And so, you know, my second chapter is about Ralph Waldo Emerson's aunt, who prays. She's an ardent, absolute, sincere, deeply convicted Christian who prays, take from me, oh my father, wealth, goods, friends, home, everything. Just leave me in possession of advancing conformity to thee. Conform to God. Don't conform to your peers, right? And so that takes a lot of work. And then I would say it gets especially difficult once you have the commercial revolution and the rise of consumer culture. And that's, you know, 20th century, so. Yeah. So it's you know, the theory of free inquiry, which is both Christian and Enlightenment concept, actually. And then the practice of, it's so hard to think for myself, you know, like, right? So I think that's an ongoing challenge. Any other questions? Comments? Yes?
Skipping ahead, currently, the religion of the U.S. Supreme Court core of Roman Catholic persuasion. One, lapsed, so he's Episcopalian. Three, Jewish, something like that. The numbers. I don't know what I am, but the point is, in my personal life, these people are driven. Accomplishment. And here is the epitome of it. Any comments about the law of the land, the law of religion, and any comments?
Well, there are these eggshells in front of me right now. I'm just going to stay right here. All right. So I don't know if anybody's read Robert Bella. He wrote a book, Habits of the Heart. And he is a sociologist by training who came up with the concept of civil religion. Okay. And I think that, my book ends in the early 20th century. So I'm really not responsible for anything that happens after that, but I think so. This liberal religion that many Christians continued to practice, but then I call them post-Christians for people who took those concepts but no longer adhere to a specifically Christian identity because they found it exclusive rather than inclusive. But then there are other Christians who are like, I can include all in my Christianity. That's no problem. Okay, so we've got. Two major explosions of thought over the course that I cover, of course, the book that I cover. So the first is around the Romantic era. So in the passage I read, I called it the Romantic turn. It's when you just get so many new texts coming in. It's no longer just English and American, but German, French, Hungarian, the religions of India, Persia. I mean, all these things exploding. So you get big diversity. We're way beyond the Congregational Church, right, by the 1830s. And then the next is around the 20th century, around the turn of the 20th century, you have so many more, like, types of people, right? The slaves are free, and they and their descendants are participating in these conversations. You have immigrants from Eastern Europe, and that's really strange, right, in the context of that moment. You have women who are uppity. Right. Yeah. All these kinds of things happen. So it's no longer just this one corner of the country having a conversation inside its established church. You have lots of people talking in lots of places and lots of things. But what was really delightful and surprising to me in the research is to find they're still adhering to the same conviction about open-mindedness and inclusivity and progress and this conviction of equality, even though their language is changing around all sorts of different things. And so at that point, I think there's an emergence of something that I'll use Bella's term, you could call a civil religion, that is compatible with more specific faith tradition and loyalties, right? So you can be in the Catholic Church and do those rituals, have those doctrines and so on, as long as they're still compatible with treating one another as equals and being open-minded and those kinds of things. So whatever faith or no faith one comes from, in order to participate in this kind of conversation, all you have to do is sign on to these principles. You're not going to do ad hominem attacks. You're going to listen. You're going to let your opponent finish, right? You're actually going to listen, right? Listen to the opposition. So I'll just tap on the top of an eggshell when I say I think there are several members of the Supreme Court who do not listen to the opposition, who do not actually take in the potential validity of viewpoints they do not share, right? And I think that's a grave problem for democracy.
But any concept of how on the highest court of the land we have people who, I'm not sure, practice, it's not a liberal, it's a discipline. Any comments about?
Well, I just have to say that, in the 20th century, at the very moment that hippies and Students for Democratic Society and all these movements were trying to go in a certain kind of liberal direction. I mean, they were critics of liberals too. So, the language becomes very difficult here. At that very moment, there was also a group of thinkers coming up with a strategy for moving the Republican Party to the right in an ideological way. And so from my perspective, shaped by this research, any ideology is anathema, actually, to the democratic process, because the democratic process has to be open-ended. You can't know where you're going. So if you think you know where you're going and where everybody should go, that means you're not open to listening anymore. You're not open to any new data, right? And so even today's sort of liberal progressives who inherit the legacy of the New Deal and think that the government should be responsible for some minimal social welfare and protections of liberties, if they say that's it, that's the end of the story, the government should do those things no matter what, in that sense, they're actually not being liberal, right? Because they're not being open-minded. And so what I think we see in the court, the dominant voice of the court, is people who have been appointed by political leaders who were wedded to a very particular program and tried to pick judges who would pursue that program. The good news is that I think that the longer justices sit on the court, the more malleable they become, because they are reading a lot of, you know, case law, and, you know, so new things happen. So that's sort of, I think, the bright side to that story. Hope. That's right. Yeah. And that's the thing. If you give up hope, they win, right? I mean, if you give it up, that's what I mean. I have a lot of students say, I don't vote. Why bother? Because it's all corrupt. And so I say, oh yeah, well, if you think that, then the people you despise will just finish the job, right? So that's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yes.
All your peers in the Puritan community and so forth, the congregation, they were very, they did not look favorably to people who disagreed with them. Isn't that true? That kind of, they were very conformist. How did the people in New England from the congregation become more open-minded?
Yeah.
How did that develop over the period?
Yeah, that is such a great question. So just to illustrate how they migrated not for the principle of religious freedom. They migrated in order to practice their own religion, right? That's a big difference. And so what examples you want to use? Anne Hutchinson, right, was a woman who criticized ministers in the community, got banished, right? Roger Williams, pretty similar. Quakers came through, ears cut off, right? I mean, really repressive stuff. Okay, so first, I want to recommend a book by David Hall, David D. Hall, and the book is called A Reforming People, okay? And it's about that generation of Puritans and compares their ideas of how society should run with the norms in England, and finds that neither the authoritarian understanding of the Puritans nor the idea that they were proto-democratic is true, but that instead there was a really intimate binding up of their spiritual convictions with the way they practice society. So even though those things I just named are true, it's also true that they believed in a principle of equity, which is justice, and that the freeholders had a voice in government. And so it was more reformist than any other place, at least in the Anglophone world. So that's one. Okay, so first I just have to excuse me. I'm not an expert on the 17th century, right? I mean, I like to read about it, but my book starts in the 18th century. And by the 18th century, this had happened. I think it was an inevitable outgrowth of a church community in which the laity also had power and therefore discussed these things, and the lack of orthodoxy, right? The lack of an overall governing body that could determine belief. And so this idea of liberty of conscience or divine right of private judgment, you know, originated as a sort of justification of their critique of the Catholic Church and of the Church of England, right? Well, this is simply what we believe, so we must. But once they claim that divine right of private judgment, it's like a germ, you know, that grows. And so by the 18th century, when intense debates were happening in the congregational church between different ministers. The liberal side is rooting its critique of Calvinist doctrine in this divine right of private judgment. And then the Calvinist side, which I call neo-Calvinist, because once they insert the evangelical revivalism, right, of Jonathan Edwards and beyond, once they insert that, it's no longer classical, right? I mean, they've innovated. If they think it's okay to go in fits and trances on the floor, they've innovated, but they're claiming it to be ancestral and orthodox and so on. They win the debate in terms of language, which I'm trying to overturn, but they continue while they're arguing with one another. Even the neo-Calvinist side says, oh yeah, divine right of private judgment. I mean, it's a pillar of their faith, right? But it's actually incompatible with their dogmatic insistence that their specific doctrines continue in unchanged form. So what it does, of course, is it leads to the split in the church, helps create the Unitarian Church in the 19th century. But meanwhile, over the course of the 18th century, the arguments were just like popcorn all over the place. I don't know how well that answers your question, but I guess it's that the Puritans were no one thing, right? They were not one particular thing. So yeah, one aspect was banishment and corporal punishment and so on. But one of the things you see in the David Hall book that I recommended is, yep, on the books, you're supposed to get punished for adultery, but in practice, nobody did. Right? So the actual implementation of those punishments were not as frequent as we think, and that their community life was instead characterized by debates over what should we do for the widow who's left with five kids to support, like that. It's very different Puritan life from that kind of representation. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It'll help others find us. Amy Kittelstrom is an associate professor of history at Sonoma State University. She specializes in 19th century American thinkers and their socio-political context. She's the author of The Religion of Democracy, Seven Liberals and the American Moral Tradition. Kittelstrom spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on July 7th, 2015. Thanks again to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Tune in next week for more great talks. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.